When A Moon for the Misbegotten was first produced on Broadway in 1957, it wasn't a huge hit, but since then, it's come to be considered one of Eugene O'Neill's finest works, and it's being revived on Broadway this season, starring Kevin Spacey and my next two guests, Eve Best and Colm Meaney, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to my show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you.
O'Neill said that he wrote the play in order to present another side of the character of James Tyrone than what we saw in Long Day's Journey and Tonight. But it's Josie who's on the stage every minute. Are you on stage every minute?
Actually, practically every minute. I go into the shack for about 2 minutes, I think, during the whole time. But then the rest of the time I am on stage.
Well, it really is a three-character play.
Yeah.
And we get to know all three of these characters almost equally well.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, there's the two, you know, a son of mine. You know, I'm playing Eve's dad and Josie, and there's also the son who gives us a lot of information at the beginning of the play about what's been going on and what's happening.
Well, he's escaping.
He's getting out. He's absolutely
getting out of
Dodge. I scared him off. Yeah. But it's a very important character as well. But I suppose the body of the play is really the three characters. Yes.
And Josie has, you have to figure out in playing Josie why she chooses to stay when all of her siblings have pretty much run away.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think she's this extraordinary person, this very, very strong woman who's surrounded by pretty... Well, about to say something about Colm. Don't listen, Colm.
All right.
Surrounded by pretty hopeless guys. And she has to, you know, and basically they're all alcoholics. And she's the one at the middle. She doesn't drink, and she's in the middle of them all, picking up everybody's pieces. And nothing, if she wasn't there, nothing would happen. I mean, they'd all just keel over. And she's the one that keeps the farm going, that does the work, that looks after everybody, that makes the food, washes the clothes, keeps everybody going, keeps everybody in line. And I think at the end of the play, even though she's aching and despairing, you know, her heart's just been ripped out of her body. And as Jim leaves, but bottom line, she's got to just. She has the strength and the inner strength and the inner sort of contact with life, I suppose. To just the important thing is to keep on going and to look after her dad.
Well, the play just takes place over the course of one day. I think it's morning to morning, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what we think we know at the beginning is quite different from what we know at the end. For example, the relationship between Josie and her father seems to be rather adversarial at the beginning. And Phil seems to be a real schemer. And then later we realize that We learn all sorts of other things about him. And you have to play it with that in mind, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's a whole, you know, the whole arc of the play is very interesting. I think from, in many ways, you know, Phil, obviously from my point of view especially, is a very intriguing character in that way, in that he develops hugely, or you know, what you see at the beginning is not what you take home with you.
And we mistrust him at the beginning.
Yes,
the audience mistrusts him.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and in that context, I think I would probably disagree with a lot of what Emily said there.
Of course you would.
About her description of these two guys. As far as Jim is concerned, yes, I completely agree. But it's of course, you know, our feelings about each character are from our particular character's perspective, and you know, that very much informs what we're doing. But the great thing about this play, I think, for all of us, was the enormous richness and depth of the relationships between these characters. Nothing is what it seems. Things are constantly shifting and changing, and that's what makes it great to play. It makes it great from an actor's point of view to be able to play that richness, you know.
Also, it's why the play has to be as long as it is. We get the same thing in Long Day's Journey, where we keep on learning new things and keep on shifting our perspectives. But is this intimidating to be in
the
play?
Not really. I mean, interestingly enough, when you say about the length of the play, we had one reviewer complain that the play was too short.
Really?
And well, yes, yeah, and it, to who shall be nameless, but it was actually, I mean, I couldn't believe it when I read this, a review actually saying that you know, the play is unbelievably short at just under 3 hours. How can you possibly do this to the to
well he suggested that you were racing through the text, and I saw it, and I mean, I read that review as well.
Yeah, Emily doesn't. Read
I didn't.
Reviews,
I don't
so
read them.
Talk
so
too much
you
about
mustn't
it.
Tell me.
But I didn't feel that was the case at all. Perhaps he wanted a much slower kind of a.
Yes,
but what's
slower,
wonderful
more
about
boring
to get back
evening.
To your question? What I love about it is that even though we've been doing this for like 8 months, and
in London,
in total we would have been doing it for 8 months because we started in August, didn't we? And it just gets richer and richer every time. There's not, you know, because quite often you do a long run of a play and after a while it gets a bit stuck and you find you're repeating a pattern of something, and this is so rich. And because what Colin said is so true, is that it's all about the relationships between these three people, and that's and they are as rich as relationships in real life, that they just keep on getting stronger and deeper and more complicated. And And so that's what makes it incredibly exciting to.
I assume absolutely. Also because we have three very strong actors here, that every night is something a little different. Somebody says something to you with a slightly different look or an intonation, and the
absolutely.
Next thing you know, you're.
Yeah, we're off to the races, absolutely. And also, strong is not the word. Emily is an incredibly strong woman. Who can, with a mere flick of her finger...
You're calling her Emily?
Sorry, yeah, that's my real name. Sorry, it's very confusing. My stage name is Eve, but I had to change it because in English Equity there was another,
there's another Emily,
Emily Best. So
but you're
to,
the best best.
I'm the best best, obviously.
Absolutely.
So I had but to change it. So
I'm sure I'm not the only one who's confused.
I know.
No,
I'm
I
sorry.
Know. Everybody is.
And the reason I said Emily there is because she hates us calling her Eve.
Yeah.
So if we call her Eve, we usually get a smack.
You get a
upside
kick.
Well, if they ever do a remake of All About Emily, I'm sure you're sorry. But we have these three very strong actors.
Yeah.
And Kevin Spacey does an amazing performance with you as well.
Yeah.
How do you work out that kind of a chemistry? Because the timing is very important.
Yeah, I don't think it's not really something you work out. I think it's something that happens or doesn't, you know. And I think Kevin and Howard Davies, our director, were very, very clever or whatever with the casting of Emily and perhaps myself, but it was, I mean, from the get-go, we did have a wonderful, the three of us had a wonderful relationship in terms of, I mean, the rehearsal process was wonderful.
Mm. Is this pretty much the same production as
you
mounted in the West End?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, with a few tiny cuts.
Yeah, a few tiny little cuts and a slightly restored, the stage is slightly different configuration. It was deeper and shallow, deeper and narrower in London, and it's sort of wider and shallower here.
I think what's great is that we make each other laugh, which is very, very important.
Well, when you say you make each other laugh as people, because there's a lot of humor in this.
Yeah,
I mean,
people,
here we have these
as
tragic characters.
And as characters.
Yeah. But there's a lot of humour in the writing, you know, and I think we discovered that in the rehearsal process. And when I reread the play, I hadn't seen the play for, I saw a production in the 80s, I think, here in New York. But I hadn't really looked at the play since then. And when I went to reread it before when I was asked to do it, I was struck by that. I was struck by the humour, and I didn't remember it from the production I'd seen. I didn't remember that much humour. But it's very, very funny stuff.
Funny and very real, and at the same time poetic.
Terribly
language.
Sad.
But O'Neill, in some way, in later in his career, finds a way of mixing poetry into naturalistic dialogue in a way that can be quite extraordinary. Mm. And these must be wonderful lines to be able to say.
Yeah, amazing. Wonderful lines.
Yeah, they are. And so, I mean, there's echoes of so much, for me, in this writing, there's echoes of other writers like O'Casey and J.M. Singh and that. I mean, I think your last line has a wonderful echo of the Playboy of the Western World there. You know, I've lost him, surely. I've lost the only Playboy of the Western World.
Wait, are you saying that O'Neill is really an Irish playwright, not an American playwright?
I think there's certainly an influence there. But no, I would concede that he is absolutely an American playwright.
I'm glad you said that. My guests are, I'm going to have to say Emily Best from now on.
No, don't. That'll just confuse
Eve
everybody.
Eve Best and Colm Meaney. two of the stars of the new production of A Moon for the Misbegotten, now at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. Also Kevin Spacey, and smaller parts, but very beautifully done by Billy Carter and Eugene O'Hare. Mm-hmm. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Eve Best and Cole Meany, two of the stars of A Moon for the Misbegotten, now being performed at the Brooks Atkinson Theater, the third star being Kevin Spacey, who has been here in the past, so we decided to have the other two important glittering actors in this performance. You were talking about O'Neill and how he had changed over the years. This is a play he didn't like, and I have a hard time understanding why, yes. Do you even do any research into the circumstances of a play before you perform in it?
Well, we did somewhat, but I mean, there's so much written about O'Neill, and so much, it's a bit like dealing with Joyce, you know, that you've got so many academics have sat down and kind of dissected them and analysed them. It's hard to know which to go to and which to believe, and it's almost like better shutting yourself off from them and just dealing with the play,
yeah,
you know.
Especially when it's something like such a famous play. Mm. And everybody's got an opinion about it. You can sort of tie yourself in knots a bit and start thinking that you're writing an essay about O'Neill instead of actually having to act these characters as real people. And I think, certainly for me, it's most helpful to think of something always that it's as if it was a new play.
Is he considered as important a playwright in England as he is here?
I think he's considered as a terribly important playwright, but he's not performed so often. I mean, in London, people had hardly ever seen Moon for the Misbegotten. It's hardly ever performed. And
it was like, it was as far 1983, as, I think, was the last production.
Yeah.
Well, we've only had three major productions here. So.
I know, but what I felt very much, especially playing Josie, was although I was familiar with the play, I wasn't aware of the hugeness of her importance as a part that actresses in America really want to play, and I was very nervous about coming.
Well,
here.
We had Colleen Dewhurst and Terry Jones, and Eve Best.
Don't tell me I had them in my head when we were opening. It was very nerve wracking.
Well, they are larger women than you, and many reviewers have noticed the difference in your physical appearance and the way O'Neill describes Josie as being so oversized for a woman that she's almost a freak.
Almost a freak.
So did you think of that more as a psychological thing than a physical?
Well, yeah, when I first arrived in the rehearsal room, I was kind of hoping that we would have the fat suit conversation, and we never did. And I was terribly insulted.
I didn't know that.
I did take Howard aside and say, "Now, you know, I mean, I know that I'm big, but am I almost a freak?" and he said, no, don't be so ridiculous. It's not about that. And it's actually, and he was absolutely right that it is about what's going on inside her.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's about her emotional state.
Well, we have more of a sense of her vulnerability.
I think so. And, well, certainly, you know, I get the feeling that if I had put on a sort of padding, it might have felt rather two-dimensional from my point of view, and it'd been about her sort of playing a type rather than playing a person, which she is. And she has this, as I think practically every woman I know has, deep-rooted fears and paranoias about the way they look, and
absolutely. And for me, you know, for me, when Josie says to me, you know, I'm just a big ugly cow and things like that, it's like for me as a dad, and I do have a 22-year-old daughter, having dealt with these issues all through the teen years, and it's just like, oh my, it's so heartbreaking, you know. And you're like, there's nothing wrong with you, you know. You're perfectly, you look beautiful. But there is self-esteem issues that so many, as Emily says, so many women have.
Although Phil isn't necessarily the most sensitive father when those kinds of things come up.
He has his moments of sensitivity. He has his moments. I mean,
depends on how drunk he is at the time.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also interesting the way people deal with these things. I mean, I remember over the years doing other like both Irish and American pieces where when people like small confined spaces or people in kind of, you know, a lot of kids in one house or in an apartment or whatever, they tend to bounce off each other with these things. I mean, they throw insults at each other without meaning to hurt or to do damage. And for an outsider, it's like it's horrible and they're cringing. But this is actually just the way these people, you know,
this is how they
live.
Talk to each other.
And it's how they kind of play with each other and taunt each other. And but it's not meant to hurt.
It's banter,
you know?
Isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Like your first line is, you haven't you got a tongue in your head, you great slut to you.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that just sounds awful. But I also suppose if that's been the sort of slow drip filter, that's been your vocabulary your whole life, it's hard not for that to sit somewhere.
Now, Colm, you've performed quite a bit in the United States, but Eve, this is your first time on Broadway.
It's my first time on Broadway.
What's taken you so long? You're very famous in England.
What?
Your first time ever in New York performing or visiting?
Both. So I'm completely, literally, I feel like I'm on the moon. Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing.
They're very loath to leave their island, some of these Brits, you know.
This is the first time I've been to this square. Where we just came. What's this building called?
This is the municipal building next door. It's the Brooklyn Bridge. You may have heard of it.
I nearly had a heart attack when we got out of the cab. And we got out of the cab, and there were two people dressed up as John Lennon and another dressed up as Cynthia Lennon. I thought I was going mad. It's amazing.
You performed this in London, and then you did As You Like It, didn't you, in between?
Yes, in between, which was a fairly nuts thing to do. But I'd been booked to do that before we even got this job. And I did, at the time, when we had sort of 3 days off over Christmas, and then I was going up to Sheffield in the snow, slightly feeling like I was holding a gun to my head. It was a crazy thing to do, but... it was great because it was a fantastic contrast from Josie to play Rosalind, who's somebody who's very confident sexually and very positive. And she gets the guy at the end. The guy stays. So that was lovely.
Now, Colm, you've performed in the United States and in England. I have to ask that question. Do audiences respond differently, let's say, to a play like this? Do you get laughs in different places? You get gasps?
Well, I have to say, I was expecting that. And when we were, you know, as we came to the end of the run in London and we knew we were coming here, I was sort of the opinion that we would have a very different audience when we came to New York. And surprisingly, it hasn't been that different, really. And I'm very surprised by that, because I think maybe 10 years ago it would have been the case. Maybe New York audiences are changing.
Well, one thing that I was upset about during the performance I went to, a number of people had their BlackBerries go off in the middle of the performance. And, you get that speech at the beginning, turn off your cell phones.
And then
And does that bother the actors?
It can be very... Well, one night it was great what happened, because there's a moment in the play, you know, when... Kevin and I, it's during that long second act bit, and he's just had a bit of a breakdown, and I'm taking him back over to the steps, and I'm trying to calm him down. And my lines are, everything is far away and doesn't matter. Enter BlackBerry. Phone started to ring, and we both looked out at the audience, and everybody in the building burst out laughing.
Yeah.
Absolutely great. And then it settled down, and my next line was, except for the moon. We all had another laugh.
Yeah. Now,
it was
round, actually. Got a round of applause. Yeah.
This is a limited run. How long is it going?
June 10th.
June the 10th. Yeah.
So there's still a chance to see it, but not all that much. And then, Colm, you'll be in Five Fingers at the Tribeca Film Festival. Mm-hmm. What can we expect to see you in, Eve? Or Emily,
big,
or whatever you are.
I'm going to have a big holiday. That's what I really need. But I would also, I'd really love to stay here for a bit if I can.
We want you to stay.
Thank you.
The first time in New York, we assume from now on you'll be making regular visits.
I hope
now that you've gotten through. A Moon for the Misbegotten, starring Kevin Spacey, Colm Meaney, and Eve Best, now at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thanks so
appreciate
much,
it.
Leonard.
We're devoting most of tomorrow's show to movies. Paul Mazursky, director of Enemies, a Love Story and An Unmarried Woman, talks about his retrospective at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. Then Chris Eigerman and Famke Janssen, the stars of The Treatment. and actress Sarah Pauley on her screenwriting and directing debut, Away From Her. It stars Julie Christie. Plus, on Please Explain, Sugar. By the way, if you were struck by something you heard today, post a comment at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Samantha Morgan Stern and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Dartu was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.